Today's presentation is part six and the final part dealing with these subjects. Today we're going to talk about the overseer. And passages that we're going to use are going to include 1 Timothy 3:1-13 and Titus chapter 1, 5-9. Here's what's on tap for today. First, the gender conundrum. We're going to deal with that. Then, what does Paul say about himself? It's critical to us understanding the New Testament. What does Paul tell us about himself? What does he say about himself, and what does he tell us about himself? What does Paul advise others to not do? Also important. Is this our hermeneutical model on its face and the rest to the wind? That is a question that we're going to answer. And finally, in part one, we're going to find out why Paul is not authorized to be an overseer or a deacon according to our hermeneutical model. Okay? First, let's do a grammatical person lesson. This is just a reminder. You all know all of this, but I'm reviewing it with you only to refresh your minds, because you do these things naturally. It's part of your character. It's just part of the way life is. You don't consciously think about it. And there's a number of examples I could give, but I'm not going to. What this has to do with is identifying specifics in grammar. Here we go. First, I is first person singular. We is first person plural. You, second person singular or plural. Now, there are options for you. It could be y'all, yous, guys. Those are some other versions of you. He, that's third person masculine singular. She, third person feminine singular. It, third person neutral singular. And finally, they, third person plural or third person gender neutral singular. Okay? So, here we go. We're going to start with 1 Timothy 3. And we're going to look at the number of errors where the translation is incorrect because they use the wrong gender. Here we go. You'll see my superscripts that'll tell you the numbers of errors. We will count up as we go. Our first version is the NIV, also known as the New International Version. Here's a trustworthy saying. If anyone sets his heart, error number one, on being an overseer, he, error number two, desires a noble task. Now, the overseer must be above reproach. The husband, error number three, of but one wife. Error number four, he must manage error number five, his own family well, and see that his error number six, children, obey error number seven, him, with proper respect. If anyone does not know how to manage error number eight, his own family, how can error number nine take care of God's church? Error number 10 must not be a recent convert, or error number 11 may become conceited and fall under the same judgment as the devil. Error number 12 must also have a good reputation with outsiders, so that error number 13 will not fall into disgrace and into the devil's trap. Verse 8, deacons likewise are to be error number 14, worthy of respect, sincere, not indulging in much wine, and not pursuing dishonest gain. Verse 12, a deacon must be the error number 15 of but one wife, and must manage error number 16's children and error number 17's household well. Titus, an elder, must be blameless, the error number 18 of but one wife, error number 19, whose children? 7. Since an overseer is entrusted with God's work, error number 20 must be blameless. 8. Rather, error 21 must be hospitable. Error 22 must hold firmly to the trustworthy message as it has been taught, so that error 23 can encourage others by sound doctrine and refute those who oppose it. So we've done a dozen verses. We got 23 gender errors. Well, you know what? When I run into this type of problem, I go to another version. Let's go to the faithful and true. KJV. Let's begin. This is a true saying. If error number one desires the office of a bishop, error number two desires a good work. Verse two, a bishop. Then must be blameless. The error number three of one wife. One that ruleth well, error number four, his own house, having error number five's children in subjection. Verse 5, for if a 6 know how to rule his 7, how shall 8 take care of the church of God? Not a novice, lest being lifted up with pride, number 9, falls. Moreover, 10 must have a good report of them which are without, lest 11 fall into reproach and the snare of the devil. The deacons be the, number 12, of one wife. Titus. If any be blameless, the 13 of one wife, having faithful children, not accused of riot or unruly. Verse 9, holding fast the faithful word as number 14 hath been taught, that number 15 may be able by sound doctrine both to exhort and to convince the gainsayer. So, in the same number of verses, the KJV has less errors than the NIV. Hoorah! Okay, well, when I run into this kind of problem, I go to another translation. Let's go to the Hebrew Roots translation, ISR. Verse 1, trustworthy is the word. If error number 1 longs for the position of an overseer, error number 2 desires a good work. Verse 2, an overseer then should be blameless. The error number 3 of one wife. One who rules number 4, his own house, having number 5 children in subjection with all reverence. Verse 5, for if number 6 does not know how to rule number 7, how shall number 8 look after the assembly of Elohim? Verse 6, not a new convert, lest number 9 become puffed up with pride and fall. Number 10 should even have a good witness from those who are outside, lest number 11 falls. Let attendance be the number 12s of only one wife. And Titus, verse 6, if anyone is unreprovable, number 13 of one wife. All right, so ISR has less errors than the KJV. Amen. All right. Let's go to another version that you guys have never heard of and never use. It's called the CEV. It's the Contemporary English Version. I know some of you got it. The number of errors will continue to appear in superscripts, counting up as we have done for these three versions. Verse 1, it is true that anyone, that's no error because that's what the gender says, who desires to be a church official wants to be something worthwhile. Verse 2, that's why officials must have a good reputation and be faithful in marriage. No errors so far. Verse 4, church officials must be in control of their own families and they must see that their children are obedient and respectful. Verse 5, if they don't know how to control their own families, how can they look after? 6, they must not be new followers of the Lord. If they are, they might become, and you all know. 7, finally, they must be well respected by people who are not followers. Then they won't be trapped and disgraced. Verse 8, church officers should be serious. I guess that eliminates me. They must not be liars. Verse 9, and they must have a clear conscience. Verse 10, they must first prove themselves. Then if no one has anything against them, they can serve as officers. Verse 12, church officers must be faithful in marriage. They must be in full control of their children and everyone else in their home. Let's go to Titus. Verse 6, they must have a good reputation and be faithful in marriage. Their children must be followers of the Lord and not have a reputation for being wild and disobedient. And verse 7, church officials who are in charge of God's work, and so they must also have a good reputation. Verse 8, instead, they must be friendly to strangers and enjoy doing good things. They must also be sensible, fair, pure, and self-controlled. Verse 9, they must stick to the true message they were taught so that their good teaching can help others and correct everyone who opposes it. Here is the only translation I have found that has no gender errors in this section. Not that anybody ever uses this version, but I'm just saying. Okay? Now, Paul says, 1 Corinthians 3:5, who then is Paul? And who is Apollos? But, read it with me, please. D-I-A-K-O-N. Deacon-o. That's deacons in plural. That's number one, by whom you believed, even as the Lord gave to every man. But what does this text say? Who then is Paul but a deacon? Paul's saying that he's a deacon. Two. 2 Corinthians 3:6, who also hath made us able deacons of the New Testament. 2 Corinthians 6:4, but in all things approving ourselves as the deacons of God. 2 Corinthians 11:23, are they deacons of Christ? Ephesians 3:7, whereof I was made a deacon. Colossians 1:23, whereof I, Paul, am made a deacon. Colossians 1:25, whereof I am made a deacon. There's a pattern here. All right? That's what Paul says. Now, what does Paul tell? 1 Corinthians 7, for I would that all men were even as I myself, which is not currently married. But every man hath his proper gift of God. Verse 8, I say therefore to the unmarried and widows, it is good for them if they abide even as I. Okay? Paul tells, Acts 26:10, which thing I also did in Jerusalem, and many of the saints that I shut up in prison, having received authority from the chief priests, and when they were put to death, I gave my voice against them. That means that he was a voting member of the Sanhedrin. All right. Now, there is an issue, and this is a minor issue, but I'm just bringing it to your attention, that the Sanhedrin, according to the Jewish historical records that I have read, required each of the members to be married. But I cannot prove that. I can only tell you what I have found. So it appears that Paul was married at this point. It appears. Okay? And this, I gave my voice against them, is really not the text. The real Greek is, I cast down my black pebble, which is part of the voting system within the Sanhedrin of the first century, the black pebble and the white pebble. It only occurs twice in Scripture, the black pebble here, and the white pebble in Revelation 2:17, which says, he that hath an ear, let him hear what the Spirit saith to the ecclesia. To him that overcometh will I give to eat of the hidden manna, and will cast in his favor the white stone of acquittal. The black stone was the stone of condemnation. But here, the white stone of acquittal will be cast in our favor. All right. And this is my, I put this here so it would be on the slides and in the PDF. To be a part of the Sanhedrin is supposed that one had to be married. But even if that is not something we want to get into, when he wrote 1 Corinthians 7, he was not married. So maybe he was widowed. That's a possibility. All right. Scripture does not say, I'm not going to take any time, but I'm just saying that's the situation there. He's not married at this time. All right. Let's move on to why Paul can't. According to our current hermeneutical model, which is on its face and the rest to the wind, 1 Timothy 3:2 says, an overseer then should be blameless, the husband of one wife. 1 Corinthians 7:8, I say therefore to the unmarried and widows, it's good for them if they abide even as I. And so we have a problem. Paul has just eliminated himself from being an overseer. He does not qualify according to the hermeneutical model of on its face and the rest to the wind. And that's how we read the New Testament. We take a scripture that is gender incorrect and form a mountain of doctrines and then wonder why we're still perpetrating the curse instead of trying to walk in restoration. And I think that's a problem. I'm concerned about it. Okay, continuing. I'm going to straighten out this mess, untangle it as best I can. Remember, you're judging what I'm teaching, to make sure that I have not gone astray. I'm going to discuss the difference between requirements and exclusions, because I have seen, based on my reading of Protestant Christians, okay, and I know they have some issues, but the reading of Protestant Christians, what I have seen is they think that everything in the scriptures I just read are a requirement. But it obviously can't be, because we have already discussed, and I won't spend a lot of time in this review, but we have established very clearly, upper level conflicts cannot exist. No matter what you think, no matter what you do, no matter what you believe, no matter how you walk, upper level conflicts cannot exist. It's an impossibility. It's like saying Yeshua is the Messiah and Yeshua is not the Messiah. And we're all good with that. That conflict cannot exist. Therefore, if we are having a discussion about requirements, Paul does not qualify as an overseer. But we know that's a conflict because Paul was the leading overseer. So that's an upper level conflict. So we're going to see if we can resolve that. And the way that I think it needs to be approached is we need to understand in the writings of Paul the difference between requirements and exclusions. And that's the section I'm going to go over. 1 Timothy 3:1. It is true that anyone, male or female, who desires to be an assembly official wants something worthwhile. That's what the text says. 2. A good reputation is required. No option there. Chaste if unmarried, faithful to a single spouse if married. Why do I say that? Because it's not husband of one wife. That's not what the Greek text says there. There were wives who had more than one husband. There were husbands that had more than one wife. The only wife that had two husbands in the Old Testament I'm aware of is David's wife, Michal. That's the only one that had two husbands that I know of. If there are others, I'm just not aware of that. In this particular time period, in this era, women had more than one husband. Okay? Now, I'm not saying Torah approves of that. I'm just saying it was in existence according to historical writings. Now, we also know that men had more than one wife in that time period, in that location. Therefore, what is being stated here is, if you are married, you can only have one spouse if you are going to be an overseer. But see, here's the thing. What if you're not married? This would be an automatic dismissal because you don't meet the requirement of one spouse, if it was a requirement. You see the problem here? So therefore, I have rephrased this because a person who is not married could still be unchaste. So I could say exclusion, but exclusion would lack coverage. It would be not complete coverage. So I've changed it to a requirement and said, if you are unmarried, you need to be chaste to be an overseer. And if you are married, you need to be faithful to a single spouse. That's the requirement of an overseer. Self-controlled, sensible, well-behaved, friendly to strangers. Those are not really options. You can't, like, tick a couple of boxes. Able to teach at some level. Why do I say that? Because in one section that we covered, it says, are all apostles, are all prophets, are all teachers. The Greek structure anticipates a no answer. That's why there's no answered in the text and in our English translations, unless it's a very liberal interpretation, you know, like phraseology type thing. It would say, is everyone an apostle? No. Is everyone a prophet? No. Is everyone a teacher? No. But the thing is that we all are teachers on a level because we're all living epistles. So you can't escape the fact that what you say, what you do, how you act, how you behave, how your character responds when you can't pre-process is a teacher to whoever's around. So in that essence, you are a teacher, but Paul's talking about a teacher at a different level. And so what I have put here is, as a requirement, able to teach at some level. Why do I say that? Because the New Testament text says those who are in authority over the body and are teachers should receive double honor. Therefore, there could be people who have administrative leadership who could be an overseer but are not called to be teachers. So we have to allow for that according to the New Testament text. But I don't want anybody to think that they're not a teacher because they're not a teacher. Everybody's life teaches the world, teaches the angelic host. We need to be aware of that. We are the visible image of the invisible God, so we're all teachers. All right, three. Exclusion, heavy drinkers, troublemakers. Can't do that. Light drinkers is probably okay, but heavy drinkers is what the text says. Required, kindness and gentleness. Exclude those driven by the desire for excessive financial gain. Everybody should have a desire for financial gain, but a desire for excessive financial gain would be a red flag question mark to me, because there could be a door could open and a foothold, compromise. That's probably why that person is excluded from being an overseer. Four, those of you that have families that are not under control. It's an exclusion because some people don't have families. So it can't be a requirement. So it has to be an exclusion. Five, those of you who have children that are not obedient and respectful. What if you don't have children? Can't be a requirement. It's got to be an exclusion. If you have children, they need to be obedient and respectful. But if you don't have children, you ride on under the pole. Okay? Six, new believers need not apply. I think that speaks for itself. Seven, those who are disrespected by unbelievers. Wow. That's a big one, ain't it? Hey, I'm just telling you what the text says. Okay, let's continue. Summary. Anyone who desires the office. Anyone who desires the office desires a good thing. I think that says a lot. There are no masculine pronouns present in all of the scripture that I just read you. Not one. Three, Romans 16:1 calls Phoebe a deacon. Junia was an apostle. And the office requires able to teach, and Paul has laid down the foundation in chapter 2. What did we see in 11 and 12, connecting those verses together? We need to provide a space in that specific instance where these ladies who were teaching people because they were new and they were teaching Aero, we need to provide them a place where they can learn in the assembly. Not learn at home. The text doesn't say learn at home. The text said learn in the assembly. That's important because we're going to see another verse that says something different, and I'm going to tell you why. All right. First, I need to give you a definition. What is an interpolation? An interpolation is a variety of things, but we're not going to go down the mathematical path today. We're going to go down the literature path. And I have to describe this because it's going to show up in the journal that I'm going to quote. Okay? What is an interpolation? An interpolation in relation to literature, and especially ancient manuscripts, is an entry or passage in a text that was not written by the original author. Now, I'm going to give you some examples of this. I want to give you a simple and quick example. You're a copyist in the first century. You got your manuscript. Maybe it's up here. Maybe it's down here, and you're writing your manuscript. And you just wrote this word. And your eyes, you're not being quite as focused as you need to be, or there's a distraction or something. Your eyes jump down three lines, and you see that same word, and you pick up the text right there. Remember, there's no verse numbers. No verse numbers. This is just all written out. All right, so you're writing along, and this whole section is missing now. So you go back, and your professor comes in and looks and says, oh, man, look at that. Okay, so then what do? You write it into the column. What's missing from the text? Or you got to do it all over again. But let's say they wrote it into the column. All right, so you got this manuscript, and it's written into the column. So now, a few generations down, this next copyist is copying this thing down, and he comes to the spot, and he sees these notes over here, and he goes, was that in the original manuscript? Or is that just the notes of somebody who was writing something in the column? I don't know, so I think I'm going to leave them out. And we propagate error. All right? I could say a lot more about textual criticism, but I think you all understand what I'm saying. So, when you see the word interpolation, here's what you think. We're talking about some text that was not originally written by the specific author. Okay? So let's go to the text of the day. 1 Corinthians 14:34. Let your women keep silence in the churches, for it is not permitted for them to speak, but they are commanded to be under obedience, as also saith the law. And if they will learn anything, let them ask their husbands at home, for it is a shame for women to speak in the church. All right? That's the verse of the day. Now, let's go to the Journal for the Study of the New Testament. I talked to you about this, the 290 volumes or something. And by the way, I made an error. That journal has now joined with another journal, and it's become a 400-volume journal. It's cool, though. I got a picture of it in my camera. It's on my tablet. Otherwise, it'd be on the screen here. But anyway, that's another story. Okay, so, but this is number 213, and the title of it is called Interpolations in the Pauline Letters. And there is the name of the author. Before we get into what he talks about, and this is only one of many that I read that dealt with interpolations of Paul, all right, I had to go over the table of contents. All right. The a priori probability of interpolations. All right. I know everybody's got that, so let me move to the next one. Okay. A priori, relating to or derived by reasoning from self-evident propositions. That helps just as much as just not even giving you anything. One guy's definition I thought was really good, and it was, you can figure it out without even getting off your couch. I like that. That I can identify with. Okay, that's good. That's good stuff. Okay. But anyway, so the pretty much you can be sure of probability of somebody writing something that was not written by the original author. And, by the way, Didascalia Apostolorum, we just saw that. It was written in the 3rd century by people who were trying to fraudulently produce a document based on the Jerusalem meeting in the 1st century. That whole thing is a interpolation. It's probably a different word when it's that big, but anyway. All right, continuing the table of contents, the absence of direct text critical evidence for interpolation. We don't have that problem, but sometimes that does exist. The burden of proof in the identification of interpolations. These are chapters. Yeah, it was a fascinating read. Evidence for interpolations. All right, so let's start these quotes. In the final analysis, the judgment as to whether any passage is interpolated depends on a variety of factors and depends on no one infallible criterion. I think that's well said. Rather, it is a matter of taking into account the cumulative effect of converging lines of evidence. In English, that means that there are a number of factors that you can check to determine whether or not this is actually belonging here, but there's not a single test that is the absolute proof that's infallible. But if you take all the different possible tests, of which there are 8, take all the possible tests that exist, and based on the cumulative weight of evidence, you can come to a decision as, well, what do you know? You think it could maybe, maybe not, maybe, yeah, no, you know, you come to that, okay? The strongest possible argument for interpolation, of course, would appeal to all 8 types of evidence. In most cases, however, this is not possible. This quote's from page 66. In the discussion that follows, I will illustrate each of the various types of evidence for interpolation by reference to 1 Corinthians 14, 34, 35. Now listen to what he says. He says, I have chosen this passage because of all the proposed interpolations in the Pauline letters, it alone appears to exhibit one form or another of all 8 types. Man, that's unbelievable. Okay, so anyway, I was like, oh, this is cool. Okay, let's go. Here we go. Number one, text-critical evidence for interpolation. Now, some of these I'm going to talk about, some I'm going to explain, some I'm going to go quickly, because I'm not going to bore you with this. I'm just trying to demonstrate that there's evidence present. That's what I want to try to do here. A, the absence of a passage from one or more of the ancient witnesses. What does that mean? That means that you've got people who are copying this stuff and copying it and copying it, and it's over here, it's in this country, it's over here, and this is a country, and you got all these things. And if you're collecting all of those together, 2nd century, 3rd century, 4th century, you're collecting them together, and you're finding these two verses are missing in a number of documents, well, that's a flag. That's a flag, okay? B, the appearance of a passage at different locations in various of the witnesses. This passage is found in verse 40 over here. It's not even found here. This one is put at the end of 1 Corinthians. It's found in Ephesians over here. That's a question. Little red flag. All right. C, the failure of an early Christian writer to cite a passage when demonstrable familiarity with the letter in which the passage now appears and congruence of subject matter would lead one to expect such a citation. Another great sentence that nobody gets. But I like this sentence. It's a really good sentence. It is. Okay, so let me explain it. All right. You've got people copying manuscripts. No question about that. We know that there were people who copied the manuscripts decade after decade. Not a question mark there. But see, there were early church fathers who would write about a subject. They're not copying the scriptures line upon line upon line upon line. They're talking about a subject which jumps all around the scriptures. And so if you have if you have not just one Christian writer, but dozens of Christian writers who are familiar with 1 Corinthians, who are talking about trying to make their case about women not being in leadership, not being teachers in the church, not being taught in the church, and they don't quote this passage? Why? Because this is a slam dunk. That passage is a slam dunk on its face. And they don't quote it. That's C. That's what that sentence says. Okay? I like congruence of subject matter too. That just rolled off the tongue. Okay. Two. Contextual evidence for interpolation. All right, contextual evidence. Context. Does it fit the context? You've got this coming down, and then right here, we completely stop the discussion, and we have something here that doesn't apply at all, and then we pick up the discussion again. Context. Three, linguistic evidence for interpolation. Linguistic could have to do with choice of words, things of that nature. Okay. Four, idational evidence for interpolation. I wanted to spell this one out, so I used a quote. Idational evidence for interpolation would be data suggesting that significant features of the substantive content of a passage, that's the main part of the passage, are not characteristically Pauline, or in some cases, perhaps that they are even anti-Pauline. For example, if I was writing a story about the Dallas Cowboys, okay, and then right here, I sing the praises of the Pittsburgh Steelers for two verses, and then I pick the story back up with the Dallas Cowboys, that would be idational evidence. All right. I thought that was good. I just made that up. Five, comparative evidence for interpolation. Okay, here we go. Would be data suggesting that significant features of a passage are more closely akin to those of known non-Pauline writings than to those of the authentic letters. We have a bunch of writings of people who have said that this was written by Paul. We know it was not written by Paul. Okay? So we're looking at that text and we're saying, wow, same vocabulary, same style, same use of the infinitive, same position of the verb. And we're looking over here, oh, it's all the same. And then he goes back to his original style. That is comparative evidence. All right? Six, situational evidence for interpolation. situational evidence that a passage reflects a situation, occasion, or set of circumstances different from that reflected in the remainder of the letter, number one, in which the passage appears, and number two, perhaps even from that known or believed to have prevailed in during Paul's time. For example, I'm writing about the Dallas Cowboys, and then I talk about the fact that the Pittsburgh Steelers up to this date still have not won a Super Bowl, and then I pick up talking about how great Dallas is. That would be a situational problem. Okay? Seven. Oh, I'm sorry, I got one more. This is a quote from his document. Clearly, however, such activity came to be regarded as problematic in the post-Pauline church because we know that there was a problem with women later on because we see it from other writings that are authentic. So if somebody got a hold of this and moved it into the text to make a statement to say, Paul wrote this, okay, there's your situational situation. Motivational evidence for interpolation. Motivational evidence would be data suggesting plausible reasons why a particular passage might have been added to one of the letters. Here's the question. Two questions to ask. Question number one, why would someone wish to add this material to one of Paul's letters? We can probably all answer that. Two, why would someone wish to attribute this material to Paul? Well, why not? He's the big dog on the block. I mean, Paul wrote that? Oh, well, I guess I better do it. All right, that's why. And the last one, number eight, locational evidence for interpolation. Would be data suggesting plausible reasons why a passage might have been inserted specifically at its present location and not somewhere else. So once again, we have, what is 1 Corinthians talking about? 14, it's talking about order in the assembly. We saw this taking place. I think we started at 11. Just trying to think back to the text that had come before that. We got 11. We're dealing with the head covering. Then we got 12, which was spiritual gifts. Then we've got 13, which is faith, hope, and love. And then we've got 14, which is I wish that all of you would prophesy, but we need to do things in order, and blah, blah, blah. And so I think what is happening here is locationally, this particular person, and I'm going to tell you who this person is in a moment, this particular person said, what a perfect location. We're talking about order, so let's deal with the women right now. And I'll tell you why when I tell you who this is. All right, continuing. While many supposed interpolations do not carry the weight of all eight criteria for evaluation, 1 Corinthians 14 does. That's directly from his book. Add to that the problem that verse 34 is just plain error on its face. Yeah, we did. You know, we could have started there and stopped there probably, but no, I couldn't do that. All right, let's break 34 down. A, let your women not speak in the ecclesia. How many verses have I already shown you where women are told to speak? I mean, that's a question. B, for it is not permitted for them to speak. Really? C, but they are commanded to be subject. What commands? The Torah? No. The written Torah does not, but the oral Torah does. I suspect that the person who wrote this was a Jew who had come out of the synagogue, accepted Yeshua, where there was a restriction on women, saw the women were out of order to some degree in Corinth, and said, what better way to deal with this? I'm going to shut the whole thing down. I'm just going to write this in right here and then send it out to everybody. That works for me. All right. Codex Vaticanus, the oldest Greek New Testament written around 350, uses a symbol 8 times. Each occurs at the exact location of a widely recognized multi-word later edition. All right? I put in, the evidence indicates that this one may mark, I put may, because textual criticism is always, you know, it's like a being on the water, a little rocky. This one may mark 1 Corinthians 14, 34, 35 as a later edition. And here's the scan. I have scanned this in. You can see I have marked the dots with a red square. In the manuscript, there are 8 locations where passages have been agreed upon by current scholarship that they are not originally written by Paul. This is one of them. So I think the evidence is reasonably good. All right, affirmations. Priscilla and Aquila explained to Apollos the way of God more accurately. These are things you already know. Philip had four daughters who prophesied. Every woman who prays or prophesies. I would like every one of you to prophesy. While everyone is prophesying, brothers and sisters, each of you has a word of instruction, a revelation. You can all prophesy so that everyone may be instructed. Brothers and sisters, be eager to prophesy. By the way, 39 comes right after. Women can't speak in the church. I'm just saying. Address to the whole assembly in Colossians 3, teach and admonish one another with all wisdom. Whoever aspires to be an overseer is to be able to teach at some level. Entrust to reliable people who will also be qualified to teach others. What, women aren't reliable? No, women are reliable. That could be a gender issue. Titus, teach the older women to teach what is good. Your faith, which first lived in your grandmother and then your mother. From infancy, you've known the Holy Scriptures. Who do you think taught him? Yeah. Hebrews. Brothers and sisters, by this time, you ought to be teachers. Phoebe, deacon. Anne, Junia. Note among the apostles. I think the evidence is kind of overwhelming. All right, let's go to our conclusions. All six combined into one. Shared leadership, not male headship. Submit to one another. Women may teach. Shared dominion in creation, not man's priority in the creation order. Women is strength corresponding to man, not the subordinate helper. Male rule is part of the curse. It is not God's ideal. Female leadership in the Old Testament. Not only males exemplify Old Testament leadership. All believers being priests is the ideal. New Testament's clear, priesthood of believers. Even though only male priests in the Old Testament. We see this in the New Testament too. Women leaders in the apostolic church, even though only males in the 12 disciples. I can only tell you what I find. Phoebe was a deacon, so was Paul. I showed you 7 verses where Paul called himself a deacon. 11, women should speak in the assembly. And 12, exclusion of women from church leadership is contrary to the gospel. If a woman's qualified and is called, to exclude her by using a New Testament that is gender deficient so we can propagate the curse during the time of restoration is an error in the body of believers. And I think it's time that we spoke to it and called it what it is. If the texts that I have looked at are correct, and I have interpreted them correctly, then something needs to move. The scriptures teach the equal standing of men and women in the assembly, including leadership, an avalanche of correctly translated. I put that in there because we saw a number of texts that had one problem or another problem or another problem or another problem. But once you get them sorted out, it's not a problem. Let us who know these truths proclaim the liberating message of the gospel. I think that that is something that we need to do. If what I have found here is true, then we need to find a way to let others know. If what I have found here is not true, then we need to find out why it's not true. Okay? So, all six messages. What was the original question? Do the scriptures teach that women, when meeting all the requirements necessary, can teach and be in leadership? That was the original question. That was the only question. Do the scriptures teach that they can, or do the scriptures clearly teach that they can't? That was the question. Okay? So, my last slide says, where do we go from here? I've done what I think I needed to do. I think I have found some pretty interesting things. So what do we do now? That's the question that's on the table.